Love Talk Radio.
Friends, and welcome to our 38th radio episode. We're coming to you live tonight from Jacksonville, Florida, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Grand Junction, Colorado. I'm Margaret Bars, one of your hosts for tonight's show. Our other hosts are Neil Holland in Jacksonville, Jim Hart on Martha's Vineyard, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, and Bill Joseph in Grand Junction, Colorado. And, of course, our producer, engineer, is Eric Otero, computer wizard extraordinaire. Now, you may call us tonight at either of our two phone numbers. That is 1-213-816-1611 or toll-free 1-877-572-1861. Now, you may also send us a message on the chat feature of the webpage that you're logged into. Either way, we want to hear from you. We try to bring you stories from Eastern's past, from those who participated in its history. Our lines are open right after the program we have for you tonight, which is one of the most unusual incidents in Eastern's history. Now let's see if you agree as we tune in to tonight's historical and true story.
Something just happened on my plane that I've never heard of before, and I'll bet you haven't either.
George Pomeroy, it's good to see you again. I want you to take a deep breath, slow down, and just tell me what happened.
With these comments from the Eastern pilot to the Charleston Stable Station manager began the search for a missing passenger on a Miami to New York flight. Was this the plan that D.B. Cooper was to copy nearly four decades later? The date was exactly March the 3rd, 1933, as our true story begins tonight. Pilot George's bet was safe. Perhaps no other U.S. airline before or after has been through an experience exactly like this. Certainly, it was a first for Eastern or Eastern Air Transport, as it was known back then on March 3rd, 1933. As Pilot Pomeroy prepared his approach to the scheduled landing at Charleston, South Carolina, en route from Miami to New York.
Now, George, are you telling me that someone got off your plane in Jacksonville that was supposed to go to New York?
No, I'm telling you that he was on the plane when I took off from Jacksonville, and somewhere in between he went missing.
All right, let's try to figure this out. I see you're flying the Ludington Airlines Trimotor Stenson Model U. We just inherited when we purchased Ludington. You've got no air hostess nor co-pilot with you like you'd have on the Condor. Sure would have solved our problem of the missing passenger. How and where were you when you discovered this, George?
Well, they loaded box lunches in Jacksonville for the passengers, and they were eating their lunch about noontime when a passenger came up to the cockpit and said, we just had a passenger that jumped out the cabin door. We were about 600 feet at the time.
Did he see the fellow jump out?
Well, he told me he heard some noise behind him and turned around toward the boarding door, and which was just slightly open, and he saw the top of the man's head outside the airplane just before the wind pushed the door shut.
Well, if you're over 600 feet, you either just took off from Jacksonville or you're on your approach into Charleston. Do you remember any landmarks when you were told by the passenger of this happening? And do you remember the passenger who told you this, so we can talk to him later?
Yeah. I'll point him out to you. I was about 600 feet and about 30 miles south of the Charleston Airport. I recall it was somewhere between the Seaboard Railway Bridge over the Edisto River and the village of Adams Run, South Carolina. Not much down there except tidal water and boggy swamps. Might be hard to find a body in that area.
Okay, well, I'll talk to the passenger, but first I want to get started with an aerial search for this missing passenger. I own Hawthorne Flying Service here in Charleston, and we have a young pilot here who can help me fly over the areas and see if we can find him. Let me call him and get an airplane in the air right away. By the way, we have one passenger boarding here going to Richmond, so you can take care of that, if you would, while I get started on the search. Hello, Margaret. Would you get Bevo Howard on the phone for me? We've got a problem over here at the Eastern Terminal. We had a passenger who apparently jumped out of the airplane.
What? Are you kidding me, Mr. Ball? Someone jumped out of the Eastern plane? I certainly hope he had a parachute on. Just a minute. Let me get Bevo for you.
Is Margaret right, boss? A passenger jumped out of an Eastern plane?
Yes, Bevo, you heard right. Now let's get the two WACOs out. We'll fly over the area and see if we can find him or what's left of him. I'll find the one with the floats, and you can get the other one.
Mr. Ball, you remember Mr. W.B. Lamb, the Jacksonville sportsman pilot? Well, he's here in our operations and has his Waco F airplane. I'll see if I can get him to join our search.
Great, Bevo. Tell him the Eastern Station Manager, Andrew McCready, will join him and his WACO, if that's okay. We'd better get to the air as quick as possible so we'll have plenty of daylight time left for our search. Sure would like to locate the body today, if at all possible. I'll report this to the state officials so they can start a ground search. And we'll all originate at the Hawthorne Flight Operations for a briefing on our search.
Okay, boss. I'll get the planes fueled and be ready to go when you get here.
All right, here it is. What we know so far. After debriefing, the passenger who saw the passenger leap from the airplane and talking with company, we know he boarded the airplane in Miami and was going to New York and then to his home in Kalamazoo, Michigan. His name is Merrill B. King. He had been to Havana, Cuba for a business meeting. Mr. King was president of Rex Paper Company in Kalamazoo. The company is contacting his next of kin to learn more, and especially what would make him want to jump from the airplane. The folks, this is John Engel, who has a teletype into Mr. Dolan, our operations manager in Atlanta. We received word that he is on his way to Charleston to help direct the search.
6 days of aerial and land search have gone by with only one discovery. A man's overcoat with a fur-lined collar was discovered near the railroad bridge crossing the Edisto River by a search party. Contacting Mr. King's relatives in Kalamazoo to see if he owned a coat fitting this description, his family confirmed that he did indeed have a similar coat, but it was still hanging in the closet. The search continued. On the third day, several in the search party met at the Hawthorne Flying Service for an update.
We have found nothing in our aerial search, and the police have had no success, so I feel we will all be questioned by the insurance people. Answer all the questions as to what you know about the search only. I am told he was heavily insured, and he was even asked he could have worn a parachute under his coat or if he could have hidden it in a rear compartment. We did talk to the passengers, and some recalled that he mentioned he had a severe headache. They also said that he had recently suffered a recent business setback.
I was asked if he could have clung to some external projections of the plane, such as the tail wheel or the horizontal stabilizer rigging, until low enough to drop off safely just before landing. I have a few days off and offered to fly the Stinson trimotor back here to Charleston for the insurance folks to take a look at it. As you know, this was not the normal plane to fly this route, for the Curtis Condors flies the route from Miami to New York daily. I brought Mr. A.P. Kerr along with me, the Florida superintendent, to help us in the another aerial search. We'll be taking off and stay up as long as we have daylight tonight.
I want to thank all of you for helping in the search, and especially you, Mr. Ball, for the use of your planes, your facilities here at Hawthorne Flying Service, and your pilot, Bevo Howard.
You know, nearly 6 months have passed when hunters came upon a human skeleton remains scattered in an open area of a forest which was being hunted. No clothing was found, but one item among the remains proved to be the clue that would solve the mystery of the passenger who leaped from the Eastern Airlines transport flight that March day in 1933. I guess you wonder what it was. It was a wristwatch with the initials MBK.
Well, folks, that's our story, and the story was written by my very good friend, John Engel. John was a longtime Eastern employee and station manager at the Jacksonville Airport for many years. John was hired in 1932 and had only been working at the Charleston Airport for a few months when this incident actually happened. He initiated the communications with the company and joined the search for the missing passenger. It was my pleasure to put the story into the radio skit you just heard.
Well, the term captain was not a title used in early commercial aviation in those days. The pilot was a senior pilot in command of the aircraft, and if the plane required a second pilot, that person was known as the co-pilot. The trimotor Stinson aircraft was part of the fleet used by Ludington Airlines when it was purchased by Eastern Air Transport, February 15, 1933. It became known as the Ludington Division after Eastern's purchase. The following provides a wide sweep of aviation nostalgia as it tracks some of those individually involved and perhaps inexorably leads to more violence.
Eastern Air Transport pilot George D. Pomeroy, who was flying the Stinson trimotor from which the passenger jumped, had started his career as the personal pilot of the president and board chairman of the Celotex Corporation, then went with the Ludington line, flying for 2 years on its New York-Washington every hour on the hour schedules. Although he came to Eastern Air Transport through the Ludington acquisition in 1933, he remained but 1 year, as the late Captain John Halliburton recalls that Pomeroy was next persuaded to commence flying a DC-2 for Cities Service Corporation, which then owned the Miami Biltmore Hotel. Captain John saw him there occasionally and said that he was a very fine pilot and had a wonderful record. Captain George died in 1979.
Eastern Air Transport, Florida Superintendent A.P. Kerr, had flown from Jacksonville to help in the aerial body search. He had been a sergeant in the old Signal Corps of the Army World War I and was justifiably proud that he had been the first non-commissioned person in the Army to be given flight training and commissioned as a pilot. Even though Eastern Air Transport, even throughout Eastern Air Transport, he was affectionately known as Pop because his steel gray hair suggested more years than his actual age. He said he had several executive posts with Eastern, and during World War II, he returned to active duty with the Army as a commanding officer at the Air Transport Command Base in Khartoum, Sudan. Later, he joined the Civil Aeronautics Authority.
Eastern Air Transport Operations Manager Carl H. Dolan, who had arranged for insurance adjusters to inspect the Stinson trimotor, through with Eastern but 3 years, distinguished himself in many phases of aviation. In the first graduating class of MIT, he received a degree in aeronautical engineering. He joined the Havilland Corporation in England before World War I. He received pilot training in the German, the Lafayette Escadrille, and was one of the 38 Americans who flew dogfights against the German planes before the United States entered the war. He was also one of only 7 of those who lived to see the end of the war, and in fact proved to be the last surviving member of the Lafayette Escadrille. In 1919, he had returned to de Havilland and was sent to China to head up the creation of the Chinese Air Force. Next, he went to Honolulu to start an inter-island airline. He was then retained by North American Aviation to survey the routes of Picarian Aviation and appraise its value. After North American bought Picarian, he was made operations manager of Eastern Air Transport. Later, was promoted to vice president operations and served until General Motors bought the company. He then became a safety investigator and was advisor to the United States Senate. Finally, settling into a quiet life in Honolulu with his wife, a member of one of the early missionary families there, he was nominated for membership in the Retired Eastern Pilots Association by Captain John Halliburton in 1981 and quickly made a member. This later recognition meant a great deal to him. He died in 1982 at the age of 86.
T.P. Preball, the airport manager for the city of Charleston, had flown out to search for the passenger's body. When Delta extended its routes from Atlanta to Charleston in 1934, he joined Delta as its Charleston station manager. On January the 1st, 1936, he became a co-pilot and in due time a Delta captain. After World War II service on the staff of General Hap Arnold, then chief of staff of the Air Corps, he returned to Delta and was made chief pilot. Later, he was promoted to Vice President of Flight Operations. He retired in 1971 and continues to live in College Park near Atlanta. When telephoned about the 3333 incident, he found his box of old flight logs and came right up with some direct quotes and activities he remembered vividly.
W.B. Lamb, yachtsman and a sportsman pilot and aircraft dealer with a hangar at Jacksonville's Anniston Municipal Airport since its early days, had happened to be in Charleston with his plane and volunteered help in the search for the body. On his return home, it was only natural for him to spread the word around the Jacksonville airport about the passenger suicide jump near Charleston. It must have made an indelible impression on Jacksonville's Louise Turk, a socially prominent, popular, and talented young lady who started flying in 1931 after she tired of racing speedboats. She was an artist and author of children's books, one with a foreword by Amelia Earhart, and she was engaged to be married to Gordon Stanton, also a pilot. Jacksonville native Harlow Barnett, later an Eastern Airlines captain based in Jacksonville, was best man at that wedding. A month later, Louise's husband was killed in an automobile accident, and her grief was repartee more than she could bear. On November 22, 1933, she took up her favorite of the airport's available planes, a new Travel Air Sport, gained enough altitude to ensure a fatal crash, and headed east out over the ocean while her gas tank ran dry. She'd left in her car at the airport a note to Lori Young, owner of the plane, and attached a check for its full value. No trace of the plane or body was ever found. So respected and admired was Louise Turk Stanton that many Jacksonville pilots flew their planes out to drop flowers at sea as a final tribute during her memorial service. The circumstances of her life and death were so unique and poignant that they later became the foundation of a Hollywood movie. Several years after her death, Jacksonville was the scene of another suicide more directly related to the Charleston incident. Airport agent Lenning Palmer, who had been on duty at the Eastern Airlines Transport Charleston office in 1933, when pilot Pomeroy landed to announce loss of a passenger, had transferred to the Jacksonville City Ticket Office in May of 1936. Soon after that, he surprised his many friends by leaping from the top floor window of Jacksonville's downtown Greenleaf building, to a quick death on a rooftop far below. It was then surmised that having enjoyed running through an earlier inheritance left by his South Carolina parents, he had decided that he could not face up to the tight budget living on depression salaries.
Beverly Bevo Howard, the Hawthorne Flying Service pilot in Charleston, who had helped in the aerial search for the body in 1933, was a native of Augusta, Georgia, and had received his early flight instruction from two future Eastern Airlines stalwart captains, Fred Dorsett and Mac Johnson, and soloed at the age of 16 before joining Hawthorne Flying Service in Charleston in 1932. 14 months after that aerial search for the body, he had a most agonizing experience. He flew Al Lute, a prominent Charleston executive, who was also his close personal friend, to Washington, D.C., and Al had been closely interested in the 1933 Eastern Air Transport passenger suicide and search. In fact, had discussed it with Bevo at that time. Returning from Washington May 31, 1934, in the Travel Air 4000, bought from Eastern's vice president, the late Sid Shannon, and just south of Petersburg, Virginia, Al suddenly released his seatbelt, stood up in the forward cockpit. Bevo throttled back, shouted, and grabbed for his arm, but his efforts were not being heeded. So Bevo reached for a heavy fire extinguisher to overpower him. Before he could wield it, Al had jumped clear of the plane and to certain death. Later that year of 1934, Bevo joined Eastern as a transportation agent, and by 1935, at age 21, became Eastern's youngest co-pilot. He was based at Newark and flew for several months before coming to the conclusion that what he called straight and level flying was just not for him. So on January 1st, 1936, when Preball became a Delta co-pilot and left Charleston, Bevo returned to Hawthorne Flying Service in Charleston as its president. Soon he established a branch operation in Mobile, and as World War II approached, he contracted to operate a number of civilian pilot training schools throughout the South to provide pilots with some basic flight training for the Army Air Corps to draw upon. By war's end, Hawthorne had trained over 6,000 pilots, including 2,000 cadets, the French government. Bevo then felt free to indulge in his first love, aerobatic competition, and became the international aerobatic champion in 1946, 1947, and 1949. He purchased the famed Jungmeister aerobatics plane that had been built in Germany and air freighted to the U.S. via the Hindenburg in 1936. Bevo performed in and won competitions in many countries. His specialty was a low pass in front of the stands, plane inverted and both arms visibly hanging down toward the ground while his vertical stabilizer clipped a ribbon stretched between two 20-foot poles. On October 17, 1971, he put on a charity performance in Greenville, North Carolina, to benefit the Greenville Boys Club and, as usual, thrill the crowd. As always, he had minimized the fuel in his tank to maximize nimbleness on the controls, and as he was completing the show, his tank ran dry when turning into his spectacular inverted pass in front of the stands at only 50 feet over the runway and was too low to recover. resulting in a tragic and fatal crash before all spectators. His plane did not burn, so it was able to be rebuilt by the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, where you can now see it hanging with its vivid striping and airshow colors. In standing alongside his airplane displayed there, if you cannot read his name painted near the cockpit, it is because the lettering, like the airplane, is upside down. Having known Bevo well enough to barnstorm with him as his ticket seller for hops, I am positive this is the way he would have wanted to be displayed, as told by John Engel. Acknowledgement for tonight's show, we must mention also in John's story that, by the way, is printed in the Best of Repartee book that was published by the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, which, by the way, is available for all to purchase at $19.95. You can purchase it at our web store on the Internet. But John received a lot of the information for the story that he wrote from Captain Ball, who was with Delta Airlines, vice president at the time, Eastern Airlines vice president of operations, the late Captain John Halliburton, also contributed to John's story, as well as the late Captain Harlow Barnett, and Eastern-based Miami and Jacksonville, and REPA's pioneer historian and Repartee's early editor, Art Birchgott, also contributed to this story. Steve?
Yes. The Stinson Trimotor Model U aircraft, this aircraft was acquired when Eastern purchased the Ludington line. There were three models owned by Ludington: the Stinson SM-8A Junior, and the Consolidated Pleaster, and the Stinson 5M-6000 Trimotor. And this was the aircraft of our story. It had three Lycoming R680 or 645 horsepower engines with a maximum gross takeoff weight of 8,500 pounds. The Trimotor had a range of about 400 miles at an airspeed of 110 miles an hour. And the seating capacity was 10 passengers and was mostly flown by a one-pilot crew. There were no air hostess serving this airplane.
Well, how do you think this kind of parallels, not quite, because it was for money that D.B. Cooper went out the air stairs of the Boeing 727 somewhere between Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington. I think we all recall that, and it's still being talked about to this day. But to have an someone back in 1933 that apparently had so many problems, financial problems, from what I have been able to read in addition to what John printed, he was quite well off, but apparently he had some bad investments. As a matter of fact, the gentleman was in Havana on a business trip. Down in Havana. Don't know whether he was trying to secure some financing or not, but apparently that was the main motivation for him to finalize his life by jumping out of the Trimotor. Any thoughts about D.B. Cooper?
I'd not particularly about D.B. Cooper, but if I could, just an observation that it is so ironic that so many suicides that were not necessarily connected to this event, but were that occurred, that were people connected with this this story one way or the other, and that's amazing. As a matter of fact, there was one mention of Larry Young, who was a father of an Eastern pilot who was about my seniority at Eastern, and whose name also was Larry Young.
Yes, Larry Young Jr., and by the way, the two of them looks almost like they could be twins. Of course, the difference between age, but Laurie, I saw him last year, and but Laurie's father, Laurie Young Sr., ran the fixed base operation here in Jacksonville, Florida. And as a lot of folks know, the history of Laurie Young here in Jacksonville, he was the pilot that flew out to meet Charles Lindbergh when Lindbergh came back by a ship from Paris, and threw out a little bottle, and in that bottle was a note to Charles Lindbergh inviting him to come to Jacksonville, and of course he did when he toured America after he came back.
Neil, this is Jim on the island. I really think we ought to be very much aware of what's going on in the marketplace now and have our crews be very, very much alert, because the way the stock market's going, we may have other people that might want to jump out of an airplane. What do you think?
Well, you know, some folks talk about in flight, you know, up in 30,000 plus feet of altitude, someone going for the door. And, of course, it would be impossible to open that door because of the pressurization.
Well, actually, I was reading a little bit about D.B. Cooper, and they said that his lasting contribution to aircraft design was, in fact, called the Cooper Vane, and that was that latching device on the Boeing 727, and it prevents the tail stairway from being lowered in flight. So
okay.
One good thing came out of that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And,
As an observation, I don't think the two are related much at all, because, first of all, you're talking about a 40-year difference of the two events almost. I don't know how old D.B. Cooper was when he jumped out of the 727, but he would have been extremely young at the time of the first incident, and I don't think that he got any ideas from that at all. I think we have a suicide in the first case and a money-making opportunity in the second case. And if I was a betting person, I don't think either one of them landed on the ground safely.
No, you're quite right there, Bill. As a matter of fact, you know, there was a similarity as to the discovery of, I was trying to find a little bit of information about what was discovered. And Margaret has that information there about the hunters that were the first to discover. What was that about, Margaret?
Well, I think that was in the autumn of 1978, and there was a placard containing instructions for lowering the aft stairs of the 727, and that was later verified to be from the hijacked airliner. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, that was found by a deer hunter near a logging road in about 13 miles east of Castle Rock, Washington. So that was well north of Lake Merwin, but still within the path of that Flight 305.
Now, I just recently drove up to North Carolina, and I was very aware of trying to find the Edisto River when I approached Charleston. And I did find something that I didn't, I never found a bridge crossing the Edisto River, but I did locate it on Google Earth. And if you do Google Earth that area, there is a large body of marshland, a tidal body, they call it. So they thought it would be very difficult to find in an aerial search. And, of course, they had the state police and state officials out looking for this fellow that jumped out of the eastern plane. But it was several months later, again, that hunters discovered the bones and eventually the watch that was found that actually solved the case that he actually had committed suicide. So that was a little similarity, but the motive, of course, was entirely different. Well, I don't know. Money?
Money, that was money. The bottom line.
One person didn't have money, and the other person wanted money.
Yeah, from the insurance.
Yeah.
So, by the way, there is, to listen to our pronunciation of that river, to the local folks in and around that area, they may not know where you were talking about, but they would know where Edisto is.
Edisto.
Okay.
Southerners have got a funny way of pronouncing words, like Mobile.
Yes.
Houston.
Right.
Houston. In Louisville, yeah.
Well, and like in Kentucky, it's not Versailles Row. I mean, it's not Versailles, it's Versailles Row.
Okay. But, yeah, and there was something else that was interesting here, Margaret.
Well, yeah, I believe in February 1980, it was told that an 8-year-old boy named Brian Ingram, he was vacationing with his family on the Columbia River, about 9 miles downstream from Vancouver, Washington, 20 miles southwest of Ariel. He actually found 3 packets of ransom cash, and it was pretty much disintegrated, still bundled, you know, in the rubber bands, and he was wanting to build a campfire, so he found this. And FBI technicians confirmed the money was indeed a portion of the ransom, 2 packets of $100 bills each and a 3rd packet of $90. And they were pretty much arranged in the same orders when they were given to Cooper, so that was a nice development.
Yeah. And, of course, there's recently been some talk from family members of D.B. Cooper that was in the paper, I think, about a month ago, and that proved to be not true.
Yeah, I think there was a lady that said that she thought her uncle was, in fact, D.B. Cooper.
Yeah.
And
the DNA didn't pan out.
That's correct.
Right, right.
You know, that that money that Margaret was just talking about, the boy took it out of the sand bank itself. It wasn't in the river. And one of the FBI conjectures were that it may have been, in fact, buried there rather than come down one of the tributaries into the Columbia River. Because had it been in the river for a lengthy period of time, the rubber bands holding the bills together might have disintegrated. Had it been buried into the sand, however, by someone, it may have stayed intact.
That's good. I think you had a Sherlock moment there. That was great.
Way to go, Bill.
I have nothing else to do out here.
by the way, how's the weather out there in Colorado?
The weather is 75 degrees. The aspens are turning yellow. The cottonwoods are turning yellow. And I just took a little tour up through Telluride. It was only 250-mile day to look at the flowers and the faunas.
It's just not fair where you and Jim Hart are.
Well, listen, let me tell you, I'm on the vineyard, and we've had some cool weather, but we heard on the radio today that Tennessee had snow.
Yeah, Boone, North Carolina had a few flakes. Steve, how about up in Roaring Gap?
We didn't get any of the flakes, but about 30 minutes away from us toward Boone, they got some.
Uh-huh.
We're expecting on the vineyard 45 to 47 degrees this evening and for the next few days.
Oh, that's
nice.
That's nice, nice. And
anybody who works in Hartford Springfield for a long period of time is entitled to live anywhere they want when they retire.
Is that Bill?
That's Bill.
Is that Bill Joseph? Let me ask you now. I worked under Hip Lloyd until 1959 or 60. Did you come on the scene after that in Hartford Springfield?
I was probably 3 or 4 managers after that. I arrived there in 1976, and I was there until 1989.
All right. Good, good. You saw a tremendous expansion in the whole area because when I first got there in 1957, we were operating on the other end of the airport with Emory Air Freight. We were selling tickets on a pickle barrel, whatever. We had nothing.
Well, I can remember when they put the first jetways in at Bradley. It happened to be with a competing airline called Delta. And I made the comment to a few of my friends. I said, well, here it is, 1970-something. I said, you know, with the snip of a ribbon, we have jumped into the 50s here. We can get jetways,
Bill,
until long after that, huh?
Do you remember, Bill, the airplane, unfortunately, it was an Electra that took off from Beantown, I think was in 60 or 61, was loaded with Marine recruits, and unfortunately, it hit the flock of birds, and it went into Boston Harbor. Do you remember that?
That was before my time, but I do remember the accident.
Yep, yep. Well, we all left Hartford Springfield. Fred Blackwell was our district manager at the time. I was a city manager in New Haven, and we all ran over to Boston. There was nothing we could do except to console the family and friends of the people on the airplane.
Right.
Hello, Neil.
Yeah, Margaret, you.
Well, actually, Bill, I wanted to ask you something. I understand that you have been in touch with Eastern President Mr. Floyd Hall. Is there anything that you can share with us about how he's doing today?
Well, you know, Margaret, I tried to get in touch with him. I've been calling him about once every 2 weeks, not to bother a person who's 95 years old. And we've had some very, very good conversations. However, I called on Saturday so that I might get an update for this program, and he wasn't feeling well. And he hadn't been feeling well for a couple of days, and I cut the conversation off. I didn't want to do anything that might jeopardize his health. What I would suggest to anyone listening and anyone who has an interest is to send Mr. Hall a card. He is very lucent. He's very much with it, and he would appreciate those cards. They can be sent to the Mertens House, M-E-R-T-E-N-S, House, 73 River Street, and that's in Woodstock, Vermont, zip code 05091. I'm sure he would appreciate them. I'm going to send a card and see if he wants to communicate by phone again, but I'm not going to rush it.
Yeah. Did you say that, didn't you tell me that about a week or so ago, Nancy, his daughter, came and took him out and took him outside?
Took him on a trip in the car around the area to look at the leaves changing. And I was very surprised at that because I was of the opinion that he rarely, if ever, got out of the residence.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does get around inside the residence with wheelchair help, and he does get on. They have a central computer there that he sometimes plays with. But I gather he spends most of his time alone, and I think that's why he appreciated the phone call. But I don't think the phone call is going to continue for much longer. I'm going to go to a card. I'm going to send a card either this week or next, and just ask him if he wants to talk to, you know, call me up. You know,
that's a good idea to share stories or you know in a card or a letter to communicate
right.
with Mr. Hall. I'm sure he would appreciate that.
He sure would. He's very, very cognizant of what's going on and appreciative of all Eastern people, I might add.
Yeah. Jim, you were going to ask something?
The thing that I wanted to mention was that it's starting to get cold here. My wife is a bit concerned because she's 85 at this point. And the cooler weather bothers her knees. And so we're leaving here next Thursday. That's the 13th of the month. I'll be on next Monday with you all. But beyond that point, I won't be on the radio until we get to Florida, which is going to be sometime around the 19th or 20th. So the Monday beyond that point, I'll be with you all. And I just want you all to know that it is still so beautiful here. The leaves, we have mostly oak leaves here, so we don't get the beautiful colors that you folks that have the maple trees have. But I'll tell you, our lobsters are still good. The clams are still fantastic. And I hate the
leaves. I think he works for the Chamber of Commerce.
I think he does, too.
Well, Jim, the dragonflies are in full bloom down here. They're flying all over the place. The love bugs.
Love
are
bugs.
Out.
I shaved my hood of my car when I went to Fort Lauderdale last week.
Oh, no. Yeah. No.
So welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Margaret. I tell you, the love bugs, I was so pleased we can run around here and we don't have to wash our windshield every other day. But we have, thank God, we have just such beautiful cool weather and no humidity.
Oh. Well, our weather has really turned for the better now. We have been in the, I guess, high 40s yesterday morning and this morning,
Great.
I think around 49 degrees. And today's temperature was about 79.
Yeah, I think it went up to 80. Around 80.
Beautiful. Yeah, but that's North Florida. You're northerners. When we come from the south, where it's 90 plus almost every day.
Well, we had 114 days this summer of weather over 90 degrees.
Wow.
So it was a record.
We had humidity that got over 10%. That's what hurts.
And Steve, you've enjoyed the North Carolina weather, I guess. It's been pretty nice.
Oh, it is. It has really been great. And you were saying it's 49 degrees in Jacksonville right now?
No. It was this morning.
Oh, that's what it is here right now. And
wow.
We're 3,000 feet up on top of a mountain, and it's the wind's blowing about 20 knots and feels like 15 degrees. So,
oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's absolutely
beautiful. Where is this, Steve? Where are you?
I am in a place called Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and it's just about 20 miles south of the Virginia border, just south of the Blue Ridge Parkway.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I envy
it really
you.
Is.
I envy you.
It is great. But now there's coming is late December, January and February, and there's the tool of choice will be snow shovels. That I don't look forward to.
The same for Bill Joseph also.
Well, you'd be surprised. Neil, out here where I live, I'm at about 6,000 feet, but I'm in a valley at 6,000 feet.
Oh,
everything
God.
Around here is up to 10 and 12,000 feet. That's where the snow goes. That's where the skiers go. I get very little snow down in this valley.
My golly.
Was that Bill?
Yeah.
Where are you, Bill?
Grand Junction, 35 miles east of the Utah border in Colorado, 250 miles west of Denver.
Fantastic.
Oh.
But you got to go up over 13,000 feet to get back on the other side of the Continental Divide, which kind of restricts winter driving with what it is, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
By the way, did any of you get a chance to listen to last Monday's special broadcast of the Music of Eastern? Did anyone get a chance to listen to that?
Well, I did, and there's about 3 or 4 minutes of silence at the very beginning, and I wanted to put in the newsletter on the website that if you leave your player on about 3 or 4 minutes, the music will finally take hold, and you'll hear the Images of Flight that was commissioned, by the way, by Floyd Hall of the Music of Eastern and conducted by Andre Castellanets and recorded by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and it came out pretty good. So if you want to hear the full album, you can tune in to episode 37. And we were all out of town, and Eric Otero, our engineer, came in and lit up the fire so that we could have at least about, I think it was about 30 minutes of music that was playing. And so that filled the gap there, so we can continue our count of episode 38, episode 39 next week.
Now, can that album be purchased?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes,
it can. Or if you make a donation to the radio show, then we send you one for your donation. And otherwise, you can purchase it by any kind of contribution that you want to make. We'll send you a copy of the CD, Images of Flight. And the quality of that CD is very, very good. You can play it just any time. By the way, it's not just the theme music of Eastern's theme music, the Wings of Man and that type of thing. The music that you hear when we sign, when we come on air, that's my favorite, as a matter of fact. But it does take some very popular songs like Oklahoma and Moon Over Miami and some of those songs, Latin American songs, and interwoven in the music is the theme music of Eastern. So that was the idea, is to take popular music and kind of weave the theme music of Eastern Airlines into it. So it was a great job, and all of us working for Eastern at the time appreciated Mr. Hall sending all of the employees of Eastern Airlines an LP copy of that record. And I still had mine for a while, and someone brought me another one, so I do have one, and that's what I got this CD recorded from.
I think that was
the girl from Ipanema part of that program.
Yeah, that was not on this album, but that was one of the music that Eastern had. They didn't commission that. I believe that gal, I can't think of her name now, that recorded that. Recorded it, and they allowed Eastern to use it in its commercials.
Well, I think that, you know, just as a gesture for Christmas, that all the co-hosts should get an actual copy of that.
Oh, all right.
You know, that
would be a
good
idea. That might be your turkey.
Yes, our turkey.
It's not really a turkey, but I mean, by the way.
Neil, you didn't call me a turkey, did you?
No, I take that back. By the way, the stories that we try to tell on our radio skits, most all of these are taken from the many years of the publication, repartee, or however you want to pronounce the word, but it's a retired Eastern Pilots Association, repartee, and 35 years of recorded magazines on a CD are also available, and you can buy that at our web store, and that's $19.95. We still have about 30 copies, and it's packaged in a very beautiful package that Jerry Frost did for the association. And he sent us several copies so that we could use them for fundraising, in which we do need funds. So if you make a donation of $50 or more, we send you the images of flight and that copy, that DVD of, not DVD, it's a CD, of Repartee's history from the very first newsletter up to, 35 years anyhow. And
yeah.
Stories like this were taken from that some of those magazines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got a comment? Someone?
Yeah, Jim is here. Just want to comment on the fact that we're closing up here on Martha's Vineyard, and we're going to be on the way south beginning the 13th of this month. And I just want everyone to know that we really have appreciated being with you all summer, and we'll look forward to returning with you next summer. However, we're going to be transferring our base of operations to the little town of Royal Palm Beach, Florida, which is 18 miles inland from West Palm Beach. And we, as of, a week or so after the 13th, will be coming to you from that point, and we look forward to being with you then. We have one more broadcast from Martha's Vineyard until we're on the way. Okay, Neil?
That sounds real good, Jim, and we don't know what our story will be for next week, but if any of you folks do have some ideas as to what you would like to hear us talk about. Oh, by the way, we did get our first foreign club member from Moscow. So we have a member of the Eastern Radio Club from Moscow. I asked him what his interest in Eastern Airlines was, and he is a student, and he has found the radio show and wanted to become a member, so he is one of our members. So perhaps we can, I don't know whether Skype goes into Moscow or not, but I want to see if I can, does it, Eric? You're probably aware of where Skype reaches out. Anywhere in the world then, right? So if I can get him, if he speaks English, his written English is, you can understand it, but I'm not so certain how he would do. Of course, my English is not that good either, but at any rate, it's interesting to know that we do have people that listen to our show from around the world. I think we're up to about 40 countries now that do tune us in. And don't know how often, but we do have people that are from China. We have one person from China that has been tuning us in. We also have folks from Thailand, from the Republic of Korea. I believe that's South Korea. Australia, New Zealand here 2 weeks ago. We had someone check in from New Zealand. So we're really getting out there. And that's the good thing about this cyber radio, where you reach around the world and it's not restricted to an antenna that can only go out maybe 50 miles, or if you're in Atlanta, WSB reaches Jacksonville. But it is kind of interesting that we do have this possibility of transmitting our show this way. And by the way, a lot of folks are listening to our show in the archive. So they're going back and picking out a show. That's why I wanted to give them a little description of each one of the shows that we do, so they can go back and pick out a show and listen to that of interest.
Oh, and Jim, by the way, we just got a text from Lou Ann in Hazard, Kentucky, and she was commenting about you leaving the Martha's Vineyard. She just wanted you to know she's also leaving Hazard, Kentucky, and she's closing up there, and she'll be here in Jacksonville, Florida, and she says she would love to come down and see you and say hello. Just giving you a heads up. He's speechless.
I think he is. He's speechless, or either he's gone. But I believe that's about all we have for this evening, for our show tonight. And we certainly appreciate you guys listening, and we hope you'll tune in and be back with us next Monday. Again, we don't know exactly what the topic will be, but we might just talk about the I think someone mentioned, Bill, you may have mentioned, no, someone else, I believe, that had called in, asked us to talk about the various presidents of Eastern through the years. And so we appreciate Bill Joseph being with us this evening, and we hope we can have you be a member of our cast when we call on you, Bill.
Anything I can do to help you, Neil.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. But, folks, that's our show for tonight. And so from all of us here at the Eastern Radio Show, as we like to say, where all the women are unequal and all the men are good-looking and all the children and grandchildren are above average, we'll say
good night, Margaret, Bill, Steve, and Neil from Jim Hart.
Good night, Jim, Bill, Neil, Steve.
Good night, Jim, Margaret, Neil, Steve.
Good night, Bill, Jim, Margaret, Steve.
Good night, everybody, from Steve.
How about Ann Luann, wherever you are?
And Luann, for wherever you are.
Oh, wait, I think she's calling in. Hey, good night, you all. Make sure you always fly right side up. I'll see you next week.
You
folks,
all.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. let you down. So many times I played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Now the time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go.